From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Today, we remember Grant Tinker. He died last month at age 90. As former chairman of NBC, he oversaw the shows Cheers, Hill Street Blues, and Saint Elsewhere. Earlier, he founded MTM Enterprises with his then-wife Mary Tyler Moore and supervised her hit show, fending off, as he often did, network suggestions.
I'm not a big believer in slavishly following research. It's one of the things that's wrong with television is that if you throw the whole decision-making process to the research department, you're not making any instinctive, visceral judgments about programs, which are show business.
We'll have an appreciation of Tinker and listen back to part of our interview with him and another with Mary Tyler Moore. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new Allison Seconds album, and David Edelstein reviews the new film La La Land. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, Fresh Air's TV critic, sitting in for Terry Gross. TV executive Grant Tinker died last week at age 90. Today, we'll listen back to Terry's 1994 interview with him, as well as a 1995 interview with Mary Tyler Moore, Grant Tinker's ex-wife, who starred in two famous and influential sitcoms with which Tinker was involved, The Dick Van Dyke Show and The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Grant Tinker was a major influence on and in television for the second half of the 20th century. He started out as an ad executive for Procter & Gamble, where he helped shape The Dick Van Dyke Show and met his future wife, that show's co-star, Mary Tyler Moore. Early in his career, he also was a low-level NBC executive for a while. But in 1970, he broke from the pack and founded MTM Enterprises, an independent TV company named after Mary Tyler Moore and showcasing her with its first television production, The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Then, Tinker took over a broadcast network, running NBC in the 1980s and bringing it from last place to first. In the case of Grant Tinker, and why he's widely considered the best and most influential network executive in TV history, it wasn't so much what he did as how he did it. Over the years, I've interviewed dozens of people who worked with and for Grant Tinker, and each and every one of them said that the most amazing and important thing about him was that he identified the people he thought were the most creative, then encouraged them to do what they wanted while protecting them from network interference. As a result, Tinker's string of hits and creative TV triumphs, either as a production executive or network chairman, included not only The Mary Tyler Moore Show, but Hill Street Blues, St. Elsewhere, Cheers, The Cosby Show, and others. Many of those shows weren't just critical and popular successes. They were groundbreakers and envelope pushers. The Dick Van Dyke Show had been the smartest TV sitcom of the 60s and became the model for The Mary Tyler Moore Show, premiering on CBS in 1970. In that series, Mary Tyler Moore ended up playing Mary Richards, a single working woman, at a time when that was a quietly but clearly feminist premise for a TV sitcom. Even in the pilot episode, during her job interview at a TV news operation in Minneapolis, Mary Richards had the nerve to stand up to the chauvinist news director Lou Grant, played wonderfully by Ed Asner.
Look, miss, would you try answering the questions as I ask them?
Yes, Mr. Grant, I will, but it does seem that you've been asking a lot of very personal questions that don't have a thing to do with my qualifications for this job.
You know what? You got spunk.
Well, yes.
I hate spunk. Tell you what. I'll try you out for a couple of weeks, see if it works out.
Oh.
If I don't like you, I'll fire you.
Right, right.
You don't like me? I'll fire you.
MTM Enterprises generated a string of smart, successful sitcoms after that, including The Bob Newhart Show. Then it changed the TV landscape again in the late 70s by taking the Lou Grant character from its Mary Tyler Moore sitcom and spinning him off into a drama series called Lou Grant. The concept there was that the content was about 70% drama, 30% comedy, but without a laugh track, just like life. It's a formula that has informed almost every quality TV drama ever since, from The Sopranos to Breaking Bad. Here's a scene from the first episode of Lou Grant. It's an intentional gender reversal mirror image of the start of The Mary Tyler Moore Show. This time, it's Lou Grant seeking a job, this time on a Los Angeles newspaper, and this time it's a woman publisher, played by Nancy Marchand, who's very clearly in charge of the job interview. She's petting a small dog as it sits on her desk, and Lou already is visibly uncomfortable.
You look like you're about to throw a punch.
It's a suit.
We've had 3 men at the city desk in the last 8 months.
I told them.
One of them died in the men's room. One quit, and I fired the third.
Why'd you fire him?
I didn't like him. I didn't like the one who died in the men's room either. Oh, Barney. Hush, baby. No. No, calm now. Yes, you little dog. You like dogs?
Yeah, I like dogs. Big dogs.
Then came another massively influential MTM production, Hill Street Blues, which brought serialized storylines and sophisticated filming techniques to the TV cop drama. From the very start, the opening roll call scene held by Michael Conrad as Sergeant Phil Esterhaus, Hill Street was a study in barely controlled chaos. And most of the good TV dramas that followed, from St. Elsewhere to L.A. Law, tried hard to emulate and equal it.
All right, item 14. Still got a gang of juveniles on 119th Street hitting on old people, cashing Social Security checks.
So, how about let's give that situation a little extra effort? All right, item 15.
Item 15. At this point in time, we got the same purse snatcher, Working Wolf from the projects on South. He's a male black, age approximately 30, 6 feet 6 inches tall, medium build. He is further described as wearing a long blonde wig, powder blue cocktail type dress, gathered in little tucks at the waist. Item 16, gang homicides.
We had two last night, so they're going to be reprisals.
Those shows, and others overseen by Tinker, changed the course of TV history and the level of TV quality. Terry Gross spoke with Grant Tinker in 1994 about his memoir, Tinker in Television. Their conversation began with the Mary Tyler Moore Show and how that show was conceived with memories of the Dick Van Dyke Show, on which the actress co-starred as Laura Petrie, the wife of Van Dyke's Rob Petrie, still fresh in everyone's minds. Early on, the lead character in the Mary Tyler Moore Show was supposed to have been divorced, an idea Tinker says didn't fly.
Yeah, that was sort of silly, I thought, because CBS resisted that a lot. I mean, it literally said things like, people will think she's divorced from Rob Petrie. We solved that problem with them by agreeing, okay, she wouldn't be divorced. She will be coming off a failed affair. So they preferred a failed affair to divorce, strangely, I thought.
How did the network feel about a single working woman?
I didn't have any problem with that concept. They did have a lot of problems when we did the show, which came off very well, the pilot when we finally did it. They did research, as networks always do, and they found all kinds of things wrong, as research frequently does. They found Mary Richards was a loser. Rhoda Morgenstern was, I don't know whether they used the word ethnic or New York, but they didn't like her. And Phyllis Lindstrom, Cloris Leachman, was abrasive. All the things that made the show as it proceeded bothered them in terms of their research. But we got sort of famous for resisting network suggestions, and we were able to maintain what we had.
Now, Hill Street Blues, when you had the pilot episode for that, the pilot tested negative, and you even reprint some of the notes in your book.
Right.
So what was wrong with Hill Street Blues, according to the research?
Oh, the pandemonium in the cop house bothered them, which at least I remember as being part of what was entertaining about the show. The fact that Ferrillo, played by Daniel Trevanti, didn't seem to be in charge. The cops were kind of, losers also. They just thought everything that turned out to be strong about the show was weak. It's very similar to the Mary situation. And I'm not a big believer in slavishly following research. It's one of the things that's wrong with television is that if you throw the decision-making process to the research department, you're not making any instinctive, visceral judgments about programs, which are show business. And many shows that went on to become very successful would never have been seen if that had been the case. I think research is a tool, one of several, but should be used much more modestly than they frequently use it.
Why'd you leave MTM to return to NBC and take over the company?
Well, because the chairman of RCA, the parent company of NBC, asked me to, and he caught me at a moment when I thought I couldn't match the 11 years of MTM that I'd already had. I had fond memories of my prior two terms at NBC. I knew a lot of people there, and I was very unhappy as I watched the network decline. And so all of those things gave me this feeling of wanting to help save the company, which was really going down for the third time. And I went back, and with the help of some very good colleagues, we did manage to save it. In fact, we succeeded beyond our fondest hopes.
So when you got to NBC to head the company, what were the problems you perceived, and how did you try to fix them?
Well, morale was one. Mm-hmm. Everybody was just very sick of losing, and so we addressed that by having a bunch of company meetings, you know, in person and connected by satellite to all the other locations, just letting people blow off steam, ask questions, make complaints, and so on. And we began to, I think, get back a sort of a family feeling that I remembered at NBC in earlier days. And then we began, well, at first, by the way, the first couple of years, we didn't do much at all. We neatened it up and maybe cut some losses, but we didn't, our programs weren't that successful. And then we began to get successful. And as I say in the book, success begets more in television. Because if you have a show like Cosby, you can put something behind it, and that show will almost automatically succeed because the audience flows into it. And as we got what we call building blocks like that, we did build other shows, and pretty soon we had a very successful network and a quality one because we had recruited mostly quality producers.
You met Mary Tyler Moore, to whom you were married for about 11 years, through the Dick Van Dyke Show.
18 years.
18 years, excuse me. Thank you. You were with the company, I guess, for 11 years.
Right.
Okay. So how did you meet her?
I met her when we did the pilot of the Van Dyke Show. Laura Petrie had, you know, nobody had really thought too much about that because, you know, the star was going to be Rob Petrie. And Mary was cast as Laura Petrie almost by a lucky accident. Danny Thomas had once read her to play his daughter, and she didn't get the part because Danny said no one would believe she's my daughter with a nose like that, hers being quite different from his. And when Sheldon and Carl were looking for and not finding Laura Petrie, Danny happened into the office one day and said, "What about that girl with the three names?" And so they called Mary in, and the result was her being cast as Laura Petrie, which that she did, so, I think, so much better and so much more completely and so much more comedically than they had hoped, that it became a more balanced show between office and home. And she really made it. I'm a suspect source to make this comment, but I think she made a huge contribution to that show.
Grant Tinker speaking to Terry Gross in 1994. The television executive and MTM production studio head died last month at age 90. Mary Tyler Moore starred in two sitcoms with which Grant Tinker was involved, The Dick Van Dyke Show and The Mary Tyler Moore Show. We'll hear Terry's interview with her after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering TV pioneer Grant Tinker, who died last month at the age of 90. Let's hear an excerpt of Terry's 1995 interview with Mary Tyler Moore. In the early 1960s, she starred as Laura Petrie opposite Dick Van Dyke's Rob Petrie on The Dick Van Dyke Show. Created by Carl Reiner, it was the funniest, most sophisticated, and most modern TV comedy of the decade. And Mary Tyler Moore, as the thoroughly modern Mrs. Petrie, was one of the show's biggest strengths. Here's a clip. Laura has just appeared on a live TV game show and tells her husband that she's upset about something she said.
No, Rob. At the very end of the show, I didn't handle myself too well with that Patrick rat.
Oh, he got you to say something embarrassing, didn't he? What was it?
That Alan Brady is bald.
Huh? You say he had no hair on television, honey? Oh, sweetheart, you knew that was a secret, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. What's the fun in telling if it's not a secret?
But Rob, he tricked me.
Oh, he tricked you. All right, he tricked you. Oh, he's very, very tricky. But telling the whole world about Alan's wig. Oh, are we in trouble?
Well, Rob, you saw the way he asked those questions. I mean, you just hardly know how to answer them.
I am surprised you didn't blab about his nose being fixed.
I didn't know Alan had a nose job.
No. Up to now, it was a secret.
What were you told about the character of Laura?
Just that she was going to be a wife, a television wife, and that really had its classical parameters and dimensions, and they were established, and they hardly ever varied except as to whether or not the wife was the star of the show, in which case she was the funny one, or if she were the straight man for the male star, and she was then totally supportive. But all these wives were kind of obedient and, you know, a representative of the vows to love, honor, and obey. They hardly varied from that. And with Carl Reiner's character, the way she was written, Laura actually had opinions of her own. And while she was asserting herself, she also didn't make Dick Van Dyke look like a dummy. It was a matter of two people. I mean, society's expectations at that point still said, hey, wait a minute, lady, you only go so far here. But I think we broke new ground. And that was helped by my insistence on wearing pants, you know, jeans and capri pants at the time. Because I said, I've seen all the other actresses and they're always running the vacuum in these little flowered frocks with high heels on. And I don't do that, and I don't know any of my friends who do that. So why don't we try to make this real, and I'll dress on the show the way I do in real life.
But it wasn't that easy. The sponsors were afraid you'd look brazen.
Right. They pointed specifically to, they used a term, cupping under. And I can only assume that that meant my seat, that there was a little too much definition. And so they allowed me to continue to wear them in one episode, one scene per episode, and only after we checked to make sure that there was as little cupping under as possible. But
cupping under referring to the fit of your pants.
The fit of the pants,
on your behind.
On my behind, right. But within a few weeks, we were sneaking them into a few other scenes in every episode, and they were definitely cupping under, and everyone thought it was great. And the funny thing is, you know, women liked me. They were not envious of the fact that their husbands had a crush on me. It was okay with them. They were the first to, you know, when I would meet people, they'd say, my husband loves you so much, and he thinks you're so sexy. And this was an odd thing, because they were also able to identify with me as a friend, as a girlfriend. There was no resentment, no fear.
Now, how did you come up with the voice to say, oh, Rob?
I don't know. I guess it began with the cry. The first time I cried was the episode in which Laura bleaches her hair blonde, looks in the mirror, and with her friend Millie's help decides she looks more like Harpo Marx than what her goal had been. And so she quickly tries to dye it back before Rob gets home from work. Now, this is a real stretch of the imagination. She decides to dye one half of her head back, not being able to get the other half done before Dick walks in the door. And so she greets him half blonde, half brunette, and sobbing. And I had always been a big fan of Nanette Fabre, who worked with Carl Reiner and Sid Caesar on the shows. And I loved her humor. I loved the way she cried. And so when I was called upon to bring forth the tears in my scene, I'm not sure how much of it was out-and-out stolen from Miss Fabre and how much of it was just a matter of influence, but there was definitely a cracking in the voice and an inability to maintain a tone and a certain amount of verbal yodeling that took place. And from that came, "Oh, Rob!"
We're listening back to our 1995 interview with Mary Tyler Moore as part of our tribute to pioneering TV executive Grant Tinker, who died last month at the age of 90. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with Mary Tyler Moore and a review of the new film La La Land, starring Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, after a break. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Home Instead Senior Care, with a range of in-home senior care services to keep senior loved ones at home, providing help with bathing, medication reminders, and Alzheimer's and dementia care at homeinstead.com/NPR. And from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization providing educational travel adventures for adults, offering departures to Cuba this winter. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today we're saluting Grant Tinker, the influential TV network and studio executive who died last month at age 90. Let's get back to Terry's 1995 interview with Mary Tyler Moore, who once was married to Grant Tinker and who starred in The Mary Tyler Moore Show, the first program created by the company named after her and founded by Tinker, MTM Productions. Tinker and Moore met when he was an advertising executive working on The Dick Van Dyke Show, on which she co-starred as Laura Petrie, the wife of Van Dyke's Rob Petrie.
Did you do a lot of rehearsing with Dick Van Dyke, or did you just have to do it minutes before the actual broadcast?
Oh, the whole show was done in what they call multiple camera technique. It's still done today. But back then, we were maybe the sixth or seventh show to use the technique. It began with Joan Davis, not Lucille Ball, as everyone thinks. Joan Davis did a show called I Married Joan.
What a girl, what a world, what a life.
Hey, yeah. Good for you. And then Lucy and several other shows followed. But in that show, it's a little like doing theater that's captured on film. You rehearse for 5 days. And then on the evening of the fifth day, the audience comes in, and the cameras, having blocked their moves and yours lined up with them, you film it from top to bottom. in continuity. So during those 5 days, it was at least the first 3 days, it was very much a matter of rehearse and contribute and attempt things and not be afraid to fail, to make a fool of yourself. Just pick yourself up, and if it didn't happen this time, then the next time you experiment, maybe it will. It was a wonderfully supportive creative environment. And Dick Van Dyke was the most generous and supportive human being that I have ever worked with, and he very strongly influenced my life and my standards when I went out on my own later on.
Oh, I have another question about Laura Petrie's look.
Yeah.
Laura wore a flip. Perfect little flip.
Yes.
Whose idea was the flip, and how were you wearing your hair in real life at the time?
In real life, I was wearing it in a flip, but it wasn't quite as backcombed and lacquered as it was on the show. I mean, that thing had so much hairspray on it, you could hang clothes from it.
When you say that thing, was it your hair or was it a wig?
Yeah, it was my hair, but it was quite thoroughly sprayed and done by somebody else. But my in person, in between shows, that was the way I wore it. It was just a little limper.
Well, let's talk about The Mary Tyler Moore Show, a show which I still love to watch. I'm so glad that Nick at Night carries these shows. I still love to watch The Dick Van Dyke Show and Mary Tyler Moore. Now, The Mary Tyler Moore Show got started because CBS wanted to build a series around you.
Mm-hmm.
And you and Grant Tinker hired people to, you know, write a series. What was the original premise?
The original premise was not too different from the one that we ended up pursuing, but I was to be divorced from a doctor, and rather than having, as we ended up doing, having me live with this doctor through medical school and internship and residency and then been dumped, CBS felt that having been divorced was unacceptable from a societal point of view, that people would see nothing humorous in divorce. How could you possibly laugh at a woman who had a broken marriage in her past? And not only that, but my God, they would think you were divorced from Dick Van Dyke, the world's most wonderful, adorable person.
That's so silly.
Yeah. And instead, what's so odd from a morality point of view is that they found it acceptable that I had lived with this doctor, never married him, and then the relationship broke up and I went off to start my new life. So I don't know. Morality, I guess, is a very personal thing.
The character of Ted Baxter was originally conceived as being someone of your age.
Right.
And there might be some, like, romantic attraction between you?
Exactly. He was probably going to be tall, dark, and handsome. And instead, what walked through the door was Ted Knight. Short, white-haired, and handsome, yes, but not what you'd call a love interest. But the writers, the writer-producers, Jim and Alan, were so open. And I think that's an important part of being a successful artist is being open to new ideas and input. And they saw this man and they began to think potential. All right, so it isn't our original idea, but oh, wow, look and feel and salivate over all the juicy stories we could do in another direction. And that's what happened. And they cast Ted.
What won them over? Was that big pretentious voice part of it?
You know, there was another thing that won them over. It wasn't just the fact that he was pomposity to the nth degree, but that there was a vulnerability and a sweetness to Ted. We found out later that Ted, who was a more out of work than in work actor, had gone out and bought himself a blue blazer and a crest and had it sewn on the pocket so that he would look the part. And everybody just thought that was, you know, real throat-clenching stuff. And, you know, if there had been any doubt about whether or not he was the right one, that clinched it.
I think one of the real famous moments in television openings, and one of the famous freeze frames, is you throwing your hat in the air in the opening of the show with the
right.
Jingle underneath.
Yeah.
Do you remember that moment?
Oh, do I? It was freezing cold. It was in Minneapolis in January, I think, or February. And we didn't know what we were doing. We were just there to grab a lot of footage that shows a young woman's exuberance, being in a new city, looking around, gazing at the sights. And I had in my hand a hat, a little beret that my aunt had given me for Christmas, and I had packed that along with whatever other warm things that I had, which weren't too many because I was a Californian, to go to Minneapolis to do these film spots. And Jim Brooks said, "Oh, I have a good idea, Bering. Take that hat, put it on your head, and now run into the intersection, and it'll be all right. We'll watch for cars." And throw it up in the air as if to say, "This is my town, and I'm celebrating my life that is taking place." And I did it, and luckily, magically, wasn't hit by a car, although I got some pretty strange looks. And in fact, I guess it must be in every episode, you can see this one woman in the background who looks at me as if not only am I the world's strangest person, but that she would like to personally lock me up. But it's interesting, isn't it, that something that becomes burned in people's impressions and memories can happen so happenstancely out of nowhere. It wasn't written. It was just a spur-of-the-moment idea.
So that traffic was the real thing.
Oh, yeah, it was. And it's a good thing I didn't have to speak any lines because my lips weren't working. It was so cold. I literally could not form words.
Huh. I have a colleague here who said, "The Mary Tyler Moore Show made me who I am today, single." And I thought that was particularly funny because, you know, all those years you were playing Mary Tyler Moore, you had no idea what it was like to be single. You got married as soon as you got out of high school. You divorced, but you were only single for about 6 months before marrying Grant Tinker.
That's right. Boy, you've read the book, haven't you?
Yes.
Yes.
So really, you'd never lived that kind of single life.
No, I hadn't. And when Grant and I finally ended our marriage and I went to New York to do a Broadway play, Whose Life Is It Anyway, I decided to stay in New York and try to capture my life for myself. I had never been on my own. I had never experienced any of the situations that Mary Richards had lived for the rest of the world every week. And I set about to make that happen for myself. I dated, I made friends, I had a little apartment, I did my own shopping and schlepped my own clothes to the dry cleaner and back and the laundry and all of that stuff. And I sort of generally played house. But in real life.
Mary Tyler Moore, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it, Terry. It's like talking with a pal.
Mary Tyler Moore speaking to Terry Gross in 1995. And now we'd like to end our salute to TV executive Grant Tinker by hearing from someone who got his big break on a television series overseen by Grant Tinker. From 2008, this is Denzel Washington.
Let's go to the very early Denzel era. And let's see if our listeners recognize you in this scene. And hint, it's the pilot for a series, a TV series that ran a long time, and you co-starred throughout the run, and it helped make you a star. So here we go, the very early Denzel.
42-year-old white, obese female, 4-day history of right upper quadrant pain, no history of calithiasis or peptic ulcer disease.
Mm-hmm. Has the pain changed with time or position?
No, physical examination temperature was 39.5 degrees centigrade, blood pressure 130 over 80, no jaundice present.
Is the abdomen distended?
No, there's a +2/4 tenderness in the right upper quadrant. The liver is 10 centimeters in breadth, 2 centimeters below the right coastal margin. There is a palpable mass just below the liver edge with a positive Murphy sign.
Jesus. That's your first scene.
I think I mispronounced that. I think it's cholelithia. I think it's cholelithiasis. And it sounds like I said cholelithiasis. I believe any doctors out there, if they call in, let me know. I believe it's cholelithiasis.
Well, that's you in your first scene in the pilot of St. Elsewhere. Yeah.
But I remember that cholelithiasis. That's interesting.
That is. I hope you never had it, whatever the heck it is.
I couldn't tell you what it is.
How did you get the part on St. Elsewhere?
I was doing a great play, and I say that because it was, called a Soldier's Play, which went on to become A Soldier's Story. Won the Pulitzer Prize in 1982.
Right, the movie version was A Soldier's Story.
Yeah, movie version was A Soldier's Story. The play was an off-Broadway play in New York. And they came to New York reading actors for this TV series, St. Elsewhere. I never really wanted to do television because I wanted to do plays and movies, and I didn't want to become well known for television, but this was an interesting script with many characters, so my agent thought, well, you know, you could get lost amongst the other characters. And so they, to make a long story long, they chose two actors, I believe, from New York, myself and David Morse.
What was the audition like?
Shoot, that was 25 years ago. I don't remember. I guess it was good. I got the part.
You don't remember what you had to do?
Oh, no. I don't. I imagine maybe I read that scene. Maybe that's what I had to do. You know, and did you say that was from the pilot?
From the pilot.
So maybe that's probably what I had to read. That's a perfect example of where your speech training and training in the classics, you know, Shakespearean training comes in to be able to say those lines.
And to rattle off all those words.
All
those medical conditions most people don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Cholelithiasis. I do remember that, though.
Denzel Washington speaking to Terry Gross in 2008. He was one of the stars of Saint Elsewhere, one of the many shows overseen by influential TV executive Grant Tinker, who died last month at age 90. After a break, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD from Allison Seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering immunotherapy and other personalized treatment options to address patients' individual needs. More about precision cancer treatment at cancercenter.com. And from Subaru, with the 9th annual Share the Love event through January 3rd. More information about the event and the not-for-profit organizations that it supports is at subaru.com/share. Love. It's what makes a Subaru a Subaru.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Little World, the second album by the California-based singer Allison Seconds. Ken says its pop songs recall an earlier era of California rock music.
In Allison Seconds' singing, even when she says the sun isn't shining, you nevertheless feel the warmth of the California sun. Her earnest phrasing bespeaks the sort of bright optimism that has characterized West Coast pop at least as far back as the early Beach Boys. The music she makes with her collaborator Anton Barbeau frequently whips up a psychedelic swirl that summons up images of trippy afternoons spent lying in the grass of a park or wiggling toes in the sand by the sea.
The apples are falling all over the ground. The angels are coming to
Allison Seconds' music connects to a certain tradition, specifically 1970s pop rock or power pop, as heard in San Francisco and Los Angeles-based groups including The Knack, Tommy Two Tone, The Plimsolls, Walter Egan, and 2020. This music was characterized by sharp little guitar hooks and catchy choruses. The songs on Seconds' album Little World were written and produced by Anton Barbeau, who has a talent for power pop replication. It comes to its full fruition on the title song. Seconds and Barbeau know how good it is. They use Little World to lead off the album. Barbeau has a tendency to drift off into whimsy and treacle in the lyrics. Sipping tea through bendy straws, loving life with all its flaws, goes a couplet in the song Octagon. It's Seconds' voice that grounds the music, keeps it from floating away at various key moments. And I should probably say Seconds' voices, plural. She sings with herself on this album. The vocals are layers of her own harmonies. She sounds like a one-woman version of the Bangles on Octagon.
Sipping tea through bendy straws, loving life with all its flaws, being happy just for the sake of it. Kiss a pretty marigold, don't get caught or you'll be told not to hang out around the nursery garden gates again. I don't know you, oh no. I don't hate you, oh no. Octagon.
I tried to find out a bit more about Seconds beyond the fact that this is her second collaboration with Barbeau, the first being the 2009 album Bag of Kittens. Seconds is based in Sacramento. Her husband is Kevin Seconds from the hardcore punk band 7 Seconds, music as far from Allison's as can be imagined. The internet also kept taking me to classes she teaches in powerlifting and weight training. Heavy stuff that finds an airy contrast in Seconds' feather-light music.
Dust beneath my wings, the pilot on autopilot sings, the intercom on, the passengers too stoned to notice. Love is everywhere, sings to the navigator's hair, sings to the cumulus laid out. The reason we are here, whisper love in every ear, open up your cosmic jar.
There are a couple of nicely appropriate cameo appearances on Little World. Nick Salomon of the British artsy pop band Bevis Frond plays guitar on Sun Don't Shine, and Kimberly Rue, who was part of a fine American pop rock band, Katrina and the Waves, remember I'm Walking on Sunshine, plays a guitar solo on I Kinda. But ultimately, it's Seconds and Barbeau who have revitalized power pop on Little World by creating an alternate universe of the sunniest sounds.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed the album Little World by Allison Seconds. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews La La Land, the new movie musical by the director of Whiplash. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. La La Land is the third film by the director Damien Chazelle, best known for his drama Whiplash, which won an Academy Award for J.K. Simmons as a sadistic music teacher. The protagonist of La La Land, played by Ryan Gosling, is also a jazz musician, but the film is a full-scale musical that also stars Emma Stone. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Damien Chazelle's romantic musical La La Land revolves around a jazz keyboardist played by Ryan Gosling and an aspiring actress played by Emma Stone, who fall lyrically in love but threaten to come uncoupled when the music stops. The movie is fantastically stylized, but for all its iridescent colors, the relationship at the center is subject to a big dose of reality. Let's talk about that stylization first. One measure of style is you don't see the effort, and Chazelle makes La La Land look easy. There's a spectacular opening, but the rest of the numbers aren't blowouts. Justin Hurwitz's songs are intimate, like humming or whistling, taken to the next level. You'd have to go back to Jacques Demy's 1964 The Umbrellas of Cherbourg to find a musical so unified. Everything, the gliding camera, the glow of the sets and costumes, the rhythms of the actors, comes together. Stone and Gosling are paired for the third time, and their chemistry is thrilling. As Sebastian, Gosling is tall, aloof, smugly self-involved, but Stone's Mia is so present that she pulls him out of his sleepy tempos. They meet cute in a traffic jam when he makes a rude gesture at her for sitting in a light, but their first real chords get struck later when she's passing a restaurant and drawn in by the sound of his playing. She sees him, the diners fade away, and then it's just a boy and girl in twin spotlights. That sounds campy, but Chazelle doesn't wink at the audience, and the attraction isn't cemented until later. Sebastian and Mia gaze down from the hills onto L.A., and against the twinkling lights and violet sky, they're so superhumanly gorgeous, they just have to sing and dance. Gosling's voice is thin but pleasing, while Stone's is breathy but full and sweet. They're not Astaire and Rogers. Their dance steps are rather simple, but the elements gel and the number is magic. A few days later, Mia can't wait to tell Sebastian some good career news.
I got a call back.
What? Come on. For what?
For a TV show. The one that I was telling you about earlier.
The Dangerous Minds meets the O.C.?
Yeah.
Congratulations, that's
really
incredible.
Exciting. I feel like I said negative stuff about it before.
What?
It's like Rebel Without a Cause, sort of.
I got the bullets.
Yes.
You've never seen it.
I've never seen it.
Oh, my. You know it's playing at the Rialto.
Really?
Yes. You should, I can take you.
Okay.
You know, for research.
For research?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Monday night, 10 o'clock.
Yeah, great.
Okay.
For research.
Mia's small hesitations are because she has a boyfriend, and she's supposed to meet him on the night she said she'll see Rebel Without a Cause. Decisions, decisions. Emma Stone's coloring, red hair, blue eyes, pale skin, just pops, and the greens and yellows and blues in which she's dressed make her more vivid yet. The clothes and the production design are in perfect harmony. Apartment walls and murals along the avenues feature illustrations of Marilyn Monroe, Charlie Chaplin, W.C. Fields, and other Hollywood icons to remind you constantly you're in, well, La La Land. But Damien Chazelle isn't a sentimentalist. His last film was Whiplash. He knows that pursuing one's art can mean leaving other people behind. Sebastian wants to make money to open a jazz club and goes on tour with a high-tech jazz rock outfit. Mia wants to be a star, and she'll go wherever she needs to. Sometimes the timing works, sometimes it's just off. But Chazelle finds the melodic thread again in a final fantasia that's like nothing I've ever seen, a musical tour de force. I know people who have a hard time accepting that a movie as stylish as La La Land isn't just fluff. I've even heard the word pastiche, suggesting it's no more than a lively imitation. Bunk. Consider the scene in which Sebastian listens to a jazz record and tries to reproduce the pianist's sound. It's not imitation for imitation's sake. He's trying to get inside the head of an artist he loves. That's what Chazelle has done with musicals like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg and A Star is Born. He's learned their language from the inside and made the form triumphantly his own.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. On Monday's show...
Miss, please turn around. Reese Witherspoon celebrated her 40th birthday in style. She had a great time.
Nothing to do with me.
I understand.
Billy Eichner talks about Billy on the Street, his TV game show where he quizzes people on the street about pop culture. Eichner also stars in Difficult People and had a recurring role on Parks and Recreation. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.B. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Some other girl guy would love this swirling sky, but there's only you and I, and we've got no shot. This could never be. You're not the type for me. And there's not a spark inside. What a waste of a lovely life.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from EuropaCorps with the new thriller Miss Sloan, starring Jessica Chastain. In the high-stakes world of politics, Elizabeth Sloan is the most feared power broker in D.C., but learns that winning comes at too high a price. In theaters today. And from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair, with some tasks completed by the next day. Details at Staples stores or staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen.